Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. First, as always, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From Houston, ExxonMobil Corp., the world's largest publicly traded oil company, reported this week income that shattered its own record for the biggest profit from operations by a U.S. corporation, earning $14.83 billion in the third quarter of 2008. American Express says it will cut 7,000 jobs, or about 10% of its workforce, as part of an effort to slash costs by $1.8 billion in 2009. Hartford Financial loses over half its market value. The company reported a third-quarter loss late Wednesday and said that it couldn't gauge the amount of extra capital it has because of market volatility. Hartford is off 51%. Assurant Inc. is off 25%. Prudential Financial is off 22%. And Cigna Corp. is off 22%. Wells Fargo announced this week it has issued to the U.S. Department of Treasury 25,000 shares of Wells Fargo's fixed-rate cumulative perpetual preferred stock, Series D, without par value. The shares have a liquidation amount per share equal to $1 million for a total price of $25 billion. This issuance is part of the Treasury Department's Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. An editorial from the New York Times this week entitled, Loans? Did We Say We'd Do Loans? According to Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, the chief proponent of the big bank bailout, flooding the banks with taxpayers' money was supposed to get them to start lending freely again. And that in turn was supposed to stabilize the markets and prevent the downturn from being worse than it otherwise would be. It was not entirely clear from the start exactly how Mr. Paulson would ensure that things would go that way. Indeed, earlier this month, shortly after the bailout was enacted, the Times' Mark Lander reported that Treasury officials also wanted to steer the bailout billions to banks that would use the money to buy up other banks. Now, lo and behold, with $250 billion in bailout funds committed to dozens of large and regional banks, it turns out that many of the recipients of this investment from taxpayers are not all that interested in making loans. It appears that Mr. Paulson is not so bothered by their reluctance. Mr. Paulson and the bailout recipients have some explaining to do. Congress should plan hearings as soon as possible and take action to set a clear strategy. In his column on Saturday, The Times' Joe Nocera told about a conference call that he had listened in on recently between employees and executives of J.P. Morgan Chase. Asked how an infusion of $25 billion of bailout funds would change the bank's lending policy, an executive said the money would be used to buy other banks. Quote, I think there are going to be some great opportunities for us to grow in this environment, and I think we have an opportunity to use that $25 billion in that way, the executive said. He added that the money could also be used as a backstop in case, quote, recession turns into depression, or what happens in the future, end quote. There was not a word about lending. not to businesses or home buyers or car buyers or students or other consumers. Just the opposite. In response to another question, the executive said that the bank expected to continue to tighten credit. J.P. Morgan Chase is not alone. The Wall Street Journal reported on Tuesday that some regional bank recipients of the bailout money had acknowledged that only a small portion would be used for loans and the rest for acquisitions and other purposes. It is prudent for government officials to encourage healthy banks to acquire weak banks. Doing so prevents bank failures and avoids the taxpayer costs and economic disruption that accompany such collapses. The problem is that the Treasury has refused to put conditions on the bank's use of the bailout funds, allowing them, in effect, to make purchases of banks that are not on the verge of failure. That could help to maximize the bank's profits, a worthy goal when the capital they are using is from private investors. However, when they're using taxpayer-provided capital, as they are now, Congress and the public have every right to require that the money be used to benefit the public directly, even if doing so crimps the bank's profits. If Treasury won't impose conditions, Congress must, including a requirement that banks accepting bailout money increase their loans to creditworthy borrowers and limit their acquisitions to failing banks, such as those listed as troubled by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The bailout should not be an occasion for banks to make a killing. An even bigger problem is that the bailout was sold as a way to spur loans. If that never was or no longer is the primary aim, Congress and the public need to know that. Lawmakers should not release the second installment, $350 billion, until they have answers and guarantees that the bailout money will be spent in ways that put the public interest first. Now, last point for the week, General Motors and Cerberus Capital have resolved the major issues in a proposed GM-Chrysler merger, but the final form of any deal will depend on the financing and government support available. As GM seeks some $10 billion in U.S. government aid to support the deal, Chrysler owner Cerberus is in its own set of intense discussion with banks to refinance $9 billion of Chrysler debt. This deal will make GM the number one automaker again, at least for a little while. GM has fallen further behind Toyota. GM's vehicle sales fell 11% in the third quarter. GM sold 2.11 million vehicles in the third quarter. That pushed GM, until recently the world's largest automaker by sales, further behind Toyota Motor Corp, which last week reported third quarter global sales of 2.24 million vehicles. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's continue in segment two of the show, looking at how to deal with your own debt and to repair your situation and create some wealth for yourself. I am starting with an important credit. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. We'll start with the recap of the major points last week, and you can also always go to the archives at www.kruufm.com, look up Life and Debt, and you can visit any prior shows in this series, all of which build one on the other for very, very good, solid points to understand about your debt healing process. The main new point we discussed last week is what Professor Warren calls the credit card hustle. So moving from one credit card to the next, if you're going to get a better interest rate, and we had looked at some of the parameters for doing that and gave a test to see if it actually would work for you. And so I'll continue on, as we did last week, with the presumption that this can work for you. So how do you make this maneuvering safely? Well, first of all, you start with an offer for a low interest credit line, typically 8% or lower. This may come from a blank check from a bank or from an internet offering, or if you aren't getting any, you can call your credit card company yourself and ask for low rate balance transfer or do some hunting on the internet. And point one is that you need to read the terms and conditions very carefully when you get the information package. An important consideration is, how did you qualify or do you qualify for the low rate? Even if you are pre-approved, the credit card company often puts people through another screening process. And even though there's some big printed advertisement saying, well, 6%, 0%, you could wind up actually paying much, much more, 29%, 26%, 22%. So you don't transfer until after you've gotten approval and read the final terms and conditions. Otherwise, you're locking yourself into a problem. The next consideration is, how long does the low rate last? If it lasts for less than 3 months, don't even worry about that kind of offer. Don't take it. It's not a good idea. Look for a minimum of 6 months. I personally suggest that it should be at least 9 months to a year to make it really a valuable process for you, because this does take some work. A third consideration is the transfer fee. There is almost always some transfer fee that's associated with this, and you have to figure out what that percentage is, how much it's going to really cost you to make this transfer, and if it is going to cost you a lot of extra money compared to what you're paying already on your credit cards, then obviously this is not something you should go for. Credit card companies often try to put this in the small print somewhere and hope that you don't notice. But it is very critical that you do pay attention and you notice what is going on with this contract that you're signing. And the next review point or recap point from last week is that once you have seen that you are within the terms that are agreeable to you for transferring the money, then you pick the best deal and transfer your balance, but you move all your high interest debt to one low interest card. It's really critical to resist the temptation to sign up for several new credit cards, even if they all have a low interest rate. Because when you start taking out many new cards at one time, this can actually lower your credit rating even more. So keep the number of cards to a minimum. And you also want to keep that goal in mind to have things as simple as possible and to minimize the risk that you're hurting yourself and your credit rating ultimately from making a mistake, just because you have so much to contend with, so many bills, so many things to move around. Third point, once you do make that deal, you have to be very careful to make every payment on time. The credit card company is looking for the very, very slightest excuse to increase your rate. And so you need to be practically perfect in every way, every month, to make sure that you are not going to get clobbered by the credit card company. The fourth point is, check your statement carefully every single month. And this was actually one of the premises when you took the test. Is this something that you have the time and the determination to do every single month, to check to see if something has gone wrong, that the interest rate perhaps has risen unexpectedly, or some extra charge or fee appears? You need to be ready to call that credit card company and to challenge that charge. And if that doesn't work, you need to be able to go to a different card, and you need to be able to do that quickly. And the fifth point is to keep track of when this offer is going to end, so you mark that on your calendar, and you know in advance that you have to make your transfer from that credit card to another low interest or 0% interest credit card before that change occurs to pay regular fees under the credit card contract, because those regular fees will be very high fees undoubtedly. So if the entire transferred balance hasn't been paid up, then you need to move that remaining balance somewhere else to not get socked with the high interest rate. The sixth point was that you need to keep very careful, very meticulous records of what is going on with the transaction. First of all, you need to keep a copy of the credit card application and all the billing statements. If you have the opportunity to scan and keep it on a computer, that makes it easier. And you need to record every one of your payments and keep track of it. Even if you miss one of those, in a lawsuit later, a company could come back and claim that you didn't make that payment and or make a payment, and it really becomes very, very critical to have the documents to show and the consistency, the regular recording of all of these payments, so you can, first of all, even short of a lawsuit, which is the nightmare later on down the road, when you talk to a representative from the company by telephone, you can always bring up the accounting that you have kept. And also when you make those calls, you need to keep track of the name of the person, the date, and all of that, so you can further keep a paper trail of what is going on. Now this may sound like a lot of work, and it is in some ways a lot of work, but it is very useful for you to do these things if you're going to be getting the advantage of the lower interest rates. And also, you want to be sure that later on it will not come back to haunt you. And the last point, the seventh point, is that we said you do not put any new charges on a credit card, because if you do, then that low interest rate, which is on the transfer balances only, will not apply to that new charge. It will be a super high rate, and that rate for the new charges will apply until after you've paid off all your low rate debt. So you can't get at that new charge or new charges until after all the transfer debt is paid off. So that becomes a challenge. So this credit card hustle kind of maneuvering is a good situation. If you're carrying lots of debt, this can save hundreds of dollars for you, and it can help you get out of your debt, your total debt, months earlier. But never forget that this is a kind of dangerous situation, a dangerous dance, and you must always look out for yourself. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So a new point for the week is negotiating your medical bills. And if you don't have health insurance, it's an important point to always try to negotiate the price of your medical care. And it really is considered a very well-kept secret that most sophisticated buyers never pay sticker price for medical care. The insurance company doesn't do that, Medicare doesn't do that, and rich people tend not to do that. There is some room to negotiate. First thing is you talk with your doctor. If you know your doctor personally, it's more likely that he or she, more than anyone in the healthcare system, is there to help you. So you explain your circumstances to the doctor, ask for a discount or perhaps a payment plan on your treatment. Doctors are very, very reasonable in giving payment plans, and they usually give very good terms and often non-interest bearing terms. Another thing you can do, if in fact you do have health insurance, is that you can ask your doctor not to bill you for the copay. Many doctors will agree to that, and perhaps they're technically not supposed to agree to this. Many do it anyway. Doctors do routinely give discounts to people who ask for them when those people are in challenged financial positions. So don't hesitate to ask the doctor. Also, you can ask the doctor if you need outside services to intervene for you, for example, at the hospital or lab services. The doctor may negotiate a discount on your behalf. And of course, the doctor has a lot more clout with the hospital and lab than you do. A second area in the medical situation is prescriptions. If you need prescriptions, you can often ask for free samples. Doctors in their offices tend to get lots and lots of free samples from drug representatives, from pharmaceutical companies, and they often have entire closets full of these kinds of samples that were dropped off by representatives of various companies. And for the most part, those drugs will just sit there, and I think they're often just forgotten. But if you confide in your doctor that you are having some cash flow problems, that doctor may cheerfully hand over a supply of the prescriptions that you need to help you out. If you are struggling, then just ask your doctor for free samples. Now, if your doctor doesn't have any free samples, there are some other ways to deal with the drug prices. One, you can check online to find out whether drug companies offer discounts for people with moderate incomes, and some of them now do. Another point, too, is that, and you often see this in your emails, that you can get drugs from Canada. And it turns out that this can be very much less expensive and it can be safe. You have to do a little homework on this and check with your doctor, but that can be a great savings for you. And the third point is that you can sign up for medical discount cards. These are sometimes available both through the government and through local public assistance situations. So check that out. And then finally, you should always ask your doctor to write a prescription for the generic drug. Do not get the brand name drugs. They're much, much more expensive. The generics will be the same and they will be much less expensive. Now, another point when dealing with medical bills, and this actually goes with a lot of purchases, but when dealing with medical bills, even if you can't get your doctor to reduce the amount, what you do is you get some cash together, you accumulate some savings in this area, and then call the billing department and make an offer to the billing department of the hospital, for example, and you will be surprised how much 10, 15, 20, 30% off the bill they will give if you have cash to pay the bill off right away in a lump sum. And of course, if you don't ask, they're not going to give you any discount. And also, if you are at first rejected when you make that offer, call back later, ask for a supervisor who may have some more power to negotiate, and do the same thing over a few times. You never know, you may get a reduction in that bill. And the final point about your medical bills is don't put your medical bills on credit cards. It is going to be much better to make a direct payment to the medical provider. You'll have more negotiating leverage than if you put your medical bill on your credit card when you're trying to negotiate that bill. And many medical providers will put you into a payment plan. I see this all the time. The emphasis with the medical profession is to help people. And of course, they need to get paid also, but they will allow you to pay reasonable, comfortable amounts every month to work through your bills. So don't hesitate to ask. And never put it on the credit card, because the credit card will have its normal interest rates and frankly, you'll get much better terms if you deal directly with the medical provider. In the last few shows, what we've been doing is dealing with creating a debt repayment plan and the various ways to accomplish that to get out of your past debt so you can build some wealth in the future. And now that you have that together from listening to these shows and thinking about it and applying the knowledge, the next thing you have to think about is not backsliding. As we promised ourselves earlier on in making a debt repayment plan, we promised that we wouldn't take on any new debt, and that's something that we mean. However, there's a lot of temptations that get us to at least think about creating more debt for ourselves. And this is backsliding, and I'd like to quote from Professor Warren: "If you struggle with or just worry about backsliding, then make the big step. Get rid of the credit cards. Melt them over the stove. Take out the pruning shears and cut them to little bits. Fold them back and forth until they pop apart. Once your debt is paid off, call Visa or MasterCard and tell them to cancel your account. You can't afford these cards." It is true that having that credit card in your wallet is one of the easiest ways to backslide. I would be a little careful about just canceling a bunch of credit cards, because this can have an impact on your credit rating. So you wouldn't do that with a bunch of credit cards. But over a long period of time, as a credit card gets paid off, it would be okay to get rid of that card in a practical sense, not having it anymore, and in a contractual sense, not having the contract anymore with the company. I think all of us know we have lived with the consequences of having credit cards. We have paid the price, and the best way to make sure we never pay it again is to take the cards out of our wallets and to destroy them. You have nothing to lose and a lot to gain if you do this. Now, a lot of people think that we need credit cards. In fact, we need them to build credit, for example. However, that's not true. It's not a necessary requirement to have credit cards. If you want to build your credit, make sure you're paying your phone bill on time, pay your student loans, make your car payments on time. There are many things that we normally do in our lives that help to build our credit and our credit rating. And one of the best things is to have some savings built, because all of these things together, the things that keep you out of debt and the things that help you to pay off your debt and to build your savings account, are the simple things that are building a life for you that is a life of comfort and eventually riches. Not using the credit cards is a very important factor in this process. They don't improve your credit, they cost a lot of money, and if you are not extremely careful, they can leave your credit rating worse off than ever before. And you may ask the question, well, there are certain things that I can only get with a credit card, like renting a car, buying things over the internet, ordering on the internet or from a catalog. It is easy to deal with that by getting a debit card, which we had spoken about in the past. This takes money directly out of your bank account, and it will cover most of what you need. As I said before, many good banks give this service for free, and it does not have any interest attached to it or costs attached to it, except for a low yearly fee for the card. And in truth, for example, when you get a hotel room or rent a car, you may need to have the debit card there for you to reserve it, but you can still check out and pay in cash, and that's the best way to actually avoid all the problems. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.